Hello and welcome to Series 3 of the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to build a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Vitok, and today's guest is Stu McDonald, the founder of Manulife, the cult peanut butter brand that started with a ton of peanuts in his bedroom in a very burnt batch that turned out to be genius. This is a conversation about doing things the hard way, often accidentally, but also about building a brand that really means something to people. Hope you enjoy.
Hi, Stu. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. Before we get into it, it'd be great to hear your background and how you came to start Manulife.
Hi, Ruth. Manulife started when I was offered a job at a company called PwC, which is a big accountancy firm. I knew I didn't really want to do it, so I decided that I'd put it off and move to Argentina, where the idea was I was going to go there and basically build up enough guilt to become an accountant for 3 years. I arrived, fell quite randomly into working for a peanut butter social enterprise, which I got pretty into pretty quickly because product's magic. If you give a child the choice between an apple and, say, Mars bar, they'll choose the Mars bar 99 times out of 100. But if you dip the apple in peanut butter, not only does it become more delicious and therefore more attractive to the child, but it also becomes more nutritious as well. So it was like, it was this magic food that I hadn't really liked before, and it was an amazing tool for getting kids to eat better. So anyway, interest grew. And one thing that happened also was the idea of like entrepreneurship, which I don't really like the word, but like starting a business, became a bit demystified because I very arrogantly thought that I could do as good, if not better, a job than the guy I was working with. So started experimenting with recipes in my friend's kitchen, like selling to the local community, got more and more into it. And then a bit of a light bulb moment happened when I basically met the family that we still source all our peanuts from today. Met them, loved them. It was around this time that I was beginning to realize I should probably go home. And I started looking at the peanut butter market back home and saw that whilst it was growing, no one was speaking about peanut butter the same way we spoke about chocolate, coffee. While in particular, there was no provenance, but it was purely commoditized. So in 2015, I came home, put off the job again, imported the first ton of peanuts from this family with the idea of starting Manulife, which was going to be the world's first like provenance-led peanut butter brand. And it was going to be like magic. And obviously it wasn't magic. It was a complete fucking disaster because the day the peanuts arrived, our production partner pulled out. So I had a ton of peanuts in 25 kilo bags in my bedroom with no one to make it. So that summer, I got together like 45 friends, rented out my old rubber club kitchen, bought two little kitchen blenders, and we made 4,000 jars of peanut butter, one jar at a time. And it was hell for me, but my friends enjoyed it. But it was also formative for a few reasons. One was, it was the beginning of this, like, we'll always find a way culture, which has played out again and again, which we can maybe touch on. But more importantly, we transitioned from what was ultimately going to be like a provenance-led co-manufactured brand, which is very copyable, right? Like, provenance is now a thing in peanut butter, I think because of us, into a brand and business that made the product in a way that no one else had done to that point and still no one else does. You still can't make Manulife in a normal peanut butter factory. Like, pretty much all the major peanut butter brands in the UK are made in the same factory, and that factory can never make our stuff. And it's because of the process we developed in that kitchen, which is quite cool. And the last one is we developed a product called Deep Roast, which is like the one we're famous for, completely by accident, because we basically burnt it and then realized it was delicious, and Deep Roast was the best thing we could come up with for burnt. And then what's followed has just been like the kind of proverbial roller coaster, which we can go into. But that's like the ground zero.
That's an amazing origin story. 10 years ago as well.
Yeah, I know. I became an accountant for a year and then quit to go to get full time end of 2016. So in my mind, it's still only 9 years, because there's like this element, which I appreciate may seem crazy from the outside, but there's this element of obviously pride to where we've got to, but also shame that we're not further along. Because I feel like the product that we have is so great, and like the reaction we get when people try it is so extreme that in my mind, and we can maybe go into the trials and tribulations that have stalled and careered the business, but like, in my mind, we should be like way further ahead than we are now. But it has been a journey, and like probably wouldn't change it because of all the learnings we've picked up along the way. It might change a few bits.
It's been a very crazy 10 years as well. There's been a lot of headwinds.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not been an easy time to launch and scale a brand.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I feel like that's definitely true. But so two things. One, I feel like now is harder because like we were like starting a food and drink brand was like starting to become quite cool, but it was maybe like, I think at the time 50,000 food businesses would start a year. Now I've heard it's something like 150,000. Like it's like mental. And obviously most of them don't last a year. But there's that. And then there's also the kind of personal aspect of had I not started, but I think I was 25 when I started, like life would have got in the way. Like the risks and hours and like just sheer energy I was able to put into it then, admittedly being like an ignorant, like mid-20-year-old who didn't know his ass from his face, versus what I could do now. I'd maybe build it in like a smarter way now, but I've got two kids, got a mortgage, like it's, I always tell people who are interested in getting into, I guess, like starting their own things, like either start as early as you possibly can or like learn all your crafts and all the stuff and start a bit later. To start something like 33, even though I look about 45, to start now would be madness.
Yeah, I think you called it ignorance, but I do think that naivety.
Yeah, that's probably a more kind way of saying it. Naivety.
It can be quite a helpful trait when you're starting for sure. Business, because if you knew of all the things that were coming your way and all the things you're going to have to deal with, and how I think that it sounds, we talked about entrepreneurship and it sounds glamorous and exciting and you're working for yourself, and reality is
you're not working for yourself, you're working for like the demon in the back right of your brain that's just like screaming at you, which is a very like young, naive driver. I think when I meet people, I'm quite friends with a guy called Toby Hoppy, who's one of the co-founders of All Things Butter. The way he's building that is very different because he's got 15 years of like in the trade learning. He's a lot calmer, appears to be a lot kinder to himself, and it's like a complete different way and it feels a bit smoother. But both have their pros and cons.
Yeah. So what did you think building a brand would be like, and what did it actually feel like in those early days?
So I remember very distinctly having a conversation with someone saying that I didn't want to build a brand because my view of a brand at the time was this like glossy, false, like constructed, like artificial thing. And I remember being very intent from the outset on being not necessarily like selling myself, but like I always used to speak of my life as a person. And one of the things that I would often parrot in the early days was like, the most interesting person in the room isn't the person shouting about themselves, it's the person asking all the questions and who are interested in others. And so if you go back to early Manny Life, it was all about the Manny Lifers and the people. And there is still an extent to that now. Flip that question that said, I didn't want to build a brand, I wanted to build something else. Ironically, as I've started to understand brands and like the power of them, and I guess like the modern trajectory of them, that is what the modern brand is. It's like your best friend in the room, whatever. As the business has scaled, there's been like tensions on keeping it personal. And there's always that thing of pulling the long lever, which is very hard to do personally, and getting into the weeds with people. And I'm still a massive proponent of the value of one-to-one interactions and how a really good one-to-one interaction, it can actually lead to hundreds of, if that person is a certain type, hundreds of kind of indirect ones.
I think it's interesting you had such a negative perception of what brand is when you started out.
Yeah, it is. I think I actually think that, so when you're in the brand world, you think of them as these magical things. And I definitely wasn't in the brand world then. I was like Joe Boggs on the street. And I actually think most people have that perception, but it's like the core nucleus that think of them as these amazing things. And you're either discovering brands like subconsciously through, it's changing a bit now, but like non-personalized glossy adverts. That was my view of brands. I was like, they're just, it's just like all rubbish. And even now I try and instill in the guys, like, don't say anything that you would be embarrassed to hear yourself say in the pub. And I think that is like a behavior that we were maybe a bit ahead of our time back then, but you're seeing that more and more come through. And those are the, like, they're getting a lot of airtime about being Ed and Amelia. Like, they've hit that super well. And it's just that authentic human interaction.
It's interesting. We had two from Lucky Saint on the podcast a while ago, and she talked about the pub test. All of your marketing strategies should be simple enough that you can, yeah, you know, say it to a friend over a pint and that they get it. But I think there's also something in that. It's interesting as a marketeer when you hear people talking disparagingly about brands. And I do think that part of the reason is because of a lot of the language that's been used by consultants and the brand house charts that have been built. Loads of really, and, you know, I've seen some that I've worked in marketing now for nearly 20 years and I don't understand them. And someone's charged thousands and thousands of pounds for this, and actually it's completely unusable, and that strategy dies if it's not executed well. And so it feels a little bit like there's a desire for simplicity, especially if you're in like a fast-moving, scaling brand.
Exactly. And what will happen, and it was almost like what tends to happen with this kind of stuff is like one person makes a like a step change move and others follow, and that becomes the norm, it becomes tired. And probably at some point, like glossy, aspirational, like untouchable comms was mega. Everyone copied it. And then we, a very good friend of ours, Alice, was involved in Oatly, and they, and part of their like insane success was they just started calling like a spade, and it's like, we're advertising on this billboard because we want you to buy stuff. And that was like really fresh. And I think what might happen is, and probably to some extent already, like people will follow that and that'll become tired and cliched, and then it'll be the next thing, which is really interesting.
This is the tiring thing about working in challenger brands, and it turns into an aesthetic, and then you have to like challenge.
Exactly, it's the hipster East London trying to look different and everyone looks the same.
So we talked a bit about then about the Manulife brand. When, how did you start shaping that identity?
In truth, it wasn't until much, much later that it became like a conscious, we're going to build the brand identity, and it's going to like using those kind of pillars you alluded to earlier. I was always very keen at being two things. This was pretty much from the outset, and we caressed them slightly as time went on, but like Manny was all about the product and like obsession over product and making the best product possible. And I think we have always done a pretty good job and an increasingly better job now of that. And then Life was about this, we exist for the people that we bring joy to, and we're this like community, like, for lack of a better word, fun, loving, feel good thing. And what we often struggled with, and to some extent still do, but less so, was like premium quality food brand was at the time like Monmouth, very like muted aesthetic. And Life was like colorful, fun, like punchy, spade to spade. And so probably the reason we've had so many like different designs is the battle of those two things. But essentially, it's always been people first, behavior-wise, backed by a really good product. And to this day, what drives us isn't this like innate interest in creating great products. It's the joy that we elicit and the kind of connections we make along the way. I frequently speak about how if the family that grew our peanuts had made honey, or anything else, I'd have started a honey or anything else brand. It was more to do with them and how much I like them than it was about this. There's an opportunity in peanut butter. I just got very lucky that it was peanut butter.
Any channels or tactics that gave you some nice early traction?
So there's all the standard ones, but one which is quite unique that I think has played a major role in that, like, community kind of evangelists feel of the brand, is that we didn't start in shops or online. We basically started with, like, peanut butter dealers. So we would create this group, and this was through the desire of bringing people together that I always had. And it was maybe like 30, 40, 50 people. And they were like Manulifers. So we'd sell them wholesale product. They were basically peanut butter drug dealers. We'd sell them 4 or 5 cases at a time at wholesale, and they would sell it to their friends, their local community. And still to this day, I'm not as close to the data as I was maybe three years ago, but I'm pretty sure that the number one driver of Manulife discovery is still word of mouth. And that's for a business that is like in Tesco, in Sainsbury's, in Waitrose. And I think that those seeds were planted, like, yeah, 2016. So that was a really interesting way to, and it probably stemmed from my complete lack of faith and this like deluded view I had on advertising, which is, I imagine, quite offensive as a marketeer, but it's, I just wasn't aware. I just didn't believe that people would buy stuff because they're advertising. And obviously there's complete rubbish. Like, people do buy stuff that they advertise to. But I was very clear that if one of my friends told me to buy something, I'd probably get and buy it.
No, I think that's definitely valid. Like, word of mouth is the marketeer's holy grail. Yeah. It's definitely much more effective than seeing an ad. I know you have done ads. So
we have, because of your friend Alice. I was very resistant, but they were great ads.
You've come round. I love the peanut butter dealers. Where did you find these people?
Just
onto, like, the street.
Events. Literally. It was, I think, we had this thing of, like, whenever I would meet someone interesting, they would show interest, and then I'd be like, do you want to be a Manulifer? And then when they came on, I would do these, like, very, and it was all, like, from the outside, this might have looked really contrived, but, like, it was all very genuine, I think it's quite a hard thing to fake, but I would do these, like, super kind of over-the-top, like, odes to the Manulifer, and then they'd start selling, and it was, and they loved it. And I think it's a very hard thing. It's virtually impossible to do now, one, because, like, the margin changes on that, but two, because we're a bit bigger. But I think there's an opportunity for brands when you're very small, one, to do things that don't scale without the worry of, like, opportunity costs of losing time elsewhere, but to, like, tap into this, like, if you like, this is a secret thing, which is just, people like love to share secrets, and there is, to most people still don't know who Manulife are, so there still is that to some extent, but just not the degree that, like, people get excited about buying 4 cases of peanut butter and selling it to their friends at the pub or the gym or the whatever, like the local theater,
back of their car.
Yeah That was genuinely how it started.
Absolutely love that. You don't hear these sorts of things these days, like small things that don't scale, and like looking at, like, weird stuff like that.
We touched on briefly, like, the tensions of, as you become bigger, the opportunity cost of time becomes greater, and there's this pressure to pull on big levers. I actually think one of the secrets to, like, maintaining the magic is to make time for things that don't scale, be it like inviting your not even your top 30 consumers, just 30 quite passionate consumers to, like, a dinner. And there are some really famous examples of brands that have done that well. Like, Mindful Chef did that, and I think still do that very well. The challenge is that to do them, there is an element of operational thinking and requirement behind those. And I just didn't have that. I still don't really have a balance of that in my body. So when the Manulife has got to 50 people and we started to think about, how do we organize these guys? Or how do we, like, make this so I'm not spending like 3 hours a day chatting to each one of them? It broke down.
Got a bit too big, not quite small enough.
Yeah, but I think you can stretch it if you can like layer on a bit of operational mindset. Mm. So how it plays out often is, I think it's got a Facebook community of 50,000, 60,000 people. And it's not quite as magic as the 50 peanut butter drug dealers, but it's pretty magic.
I like it when you hear about brands who do these things, but they don't yell about it. So it adds to it as well, doesn't it? You hear about it, but no one's really told you versus
exactly. And that's part of the magic, because imagine if Mindful Chef ran like a meta ad about like joining their Facebook, it'd be like so lame. But it is going back to that, if like coming to the secret.
Was there a sort of turning point when you thought this is actually working?
So we'd always known that if 100 people tried Man Life, like 40 would buy it and 10 of those would tell all of their friends. Right, at least I think Alice will know the actual numbers. I think maybe it's like better than that. And so originally it was 100, we'd speak to 100 people and then they'd tell 10s of their friends. Then we started going into independents and it maybe became thousands. And then we launched in Waitrose, and Waitrose backed us in quite a major way. And all of a sudden it was like thousands and tens of thousands telling thousands of their friends. And that was like, okay, want something. And then, so that was the first, oh, this is quite exciting. And then the big one was when COVID lockdown hit. We were pretty like under distributed for the quality of product and brand that we were, but we had a fairly solid online setting. And so when lockdown hit and people stopped going out and everyone moved online, it like democratized access. So the like lack of distribution that had been maybe holding us back suddenly wasn't a thing. And the business more or less quadrupled overnight, which is quite challenging to deal with, and had it like knock-on effects thereafter. And that was like reviews, word of mouth, and people wanting good stuff. And so it hasn't been straightforward since then, but since then there's been...
Do you have to get your 40 friends back to the kitchen?
Not in 2020, but the year before, yeah. And I'll send you some pictures of that Christmas.
Yes, please do. Let's talk a bit about culture. You mentioned it briefly before. What kind of culture are you consciously trying to build at Manny Life?
One of the big changes that we have put in place in the last year is that I promoted some finance director to be MD. So I no longer run the business day to day, which is for the business and for me and probably for my wife and kids, actually a great thing. And he's doing a great job. It's really Johnny's job to like instill that. But one of the things we are very aligned on is being like a people first business. So treat people well, try. And it's hard because obviously as the business gets really busy, like eating lunch together and like birthdays, particularly as I guess a bloke, so generally aren't very good with that kind of thing, falls away. But I think we do a pretty good job of treating our people well and fairly, and not just our team, but like our suppliers and our customers. And then paired with that is this, which again is in conflict. There's a lot of conflict, but this like just relentless pursuit of better. We haven't done the kind of classic, these are our values up on the wall thing. I think we flirted with it at one point, but like behaviors. And we're still small enough that like the behaviors that the team and the leaders in the team can emulate are passed through.
You've got a sort of living culture rather than exactly. A written one.
Yes. Yeah. But that is definitely, I'm not sure how you found it with your business, but like that is definitely, there is definitely a requirement to be a lot more conscious of it now that we're no longer in the 5 days a week all together. Like it was fairly straightforward to emulate that because you would behave a certain way at work and then you would let a load off on a Thursday evening with the team, like impromptu drinks. And the impromptu element of culture doesn't really happen anymore. So you probably could be a bit more deliberate about it, to be honest.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because there's culture and then there's sort of values, how leader you want to be and how you want people to feel working for you and with you, and the two things, it's a hard thing to get right. And I think a lot of it, I think businesses as they scale really struggle with that, because when you're a small team, I remember Pop Chips for a really long time, and when there's only a handful of you, it's fine because you don't really need to say a lot of things. You don't have to have a policy on this. If someone wants to go do this, and you're like, yeah, sure, and then suddenly there's 25 of you, and it's that person's just done that, and it's a tricky thing to navigate that growing from it being an unsaid thing.
Yeah, for sure. And it's also particularly difficult when, so we've always been involved in our production, but historically we put our own kit in third parties and they ran it. So like the teams weren't ours, but as of end of last year, we manage all our productions. We have office team that are in London 2 days a week, and we have production team that are 5 days a week in the manufacturing in Shirebrook. And we had a lot of people telling us that like the idea of giving the kind of benefits that the head office team get to line staff would be like insane. But to maybe our credit, we pushed back on that. And I think the line team at May, like the operators, have like basically the same benefits as the head office team.
That is rare. That is unusual. Yeah. What has been your biggest leadership learning so far?
Very hard to not give the cliche. And it's the same one as everyone says. It's just find great people. Tell them where, describe where you want to get to and lead them to it and get out of the way. And that is something that I personally really struggled with. And I think it was because I was so like passionate and I guess like passionate, verging on obsessed, that would describe where we wanted to get to. But then my mind would go into all the details of what everyone was doing. And that is one of the reasons why promoting, I was finance director and like having this new dream role, has worked so well, because it's almost like a layer. So it's like a structural means of stopping that impulse. But yeah, with great people, everything becomes far easier.
I guess it's, I don't think it's super cliche, but it's probably common answer for a reason, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's hard because A, finding great people is hard.
Yeah.
B, knowing where you need them is difficult sometimes.
Yeah.
Like knowing what you don't know or what, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, like you say, getting out of the way is hard when it's your baby and it's your passion. So it sounds simple. And it's like one of those things you say, okay, so I've identified that this is the most important thing to do.
No. I think there's one thing that is, again, a bit of a cliche, but it's, and this isn't an answer, but the mix of experience and attitude is very important. And often, particularly for like your kind of 5 to 15 or even like 1 to 10 million part of the journey, like the mistake is like overvalue experience, undervalue attitude. And again, like you figure that out, and it's a very hard thing to get right until you see the people in the business. So I guess part of that is, again, cliche, like hire slow, and then if it's not working, move people on quickly.
It's the right kind of experience though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Because
fast growth FMCG businesses, I think, are just quite a specific thing.
Very intense.
Be different. Fast moving, isn't it, in a way that a lot of so I think there is something about having the right kind of experience in the right kind of businesses.
Another one is advice and advisors and mentors are very valuable, but they are only as valuable as your ability to like process them. And I see, particularly with very exciting businesses, because very exciting businesses, like, and there's a lot of people who built and sold or built and like almost sold food business that know a lot of stuff. And what can often happen with them is they can get like swarmed by very passionate, very opinionated advisors, which like to some extent we went through, and you just get pulled from pillar to post. Particularly as it's quite not infrequent that food and drink founders are like new to food. And they're very fresh, and they're often like insecure high achievers and people pleasers, and that is quite a dangerous like mix.
Yeah, I do some advisory, so I feel like I'm on the other side of that. There is such a thing as too much, even good advice. There's no specific way to do any of these things. Yeah. There's something that's worked for someone, but that doesn't mean it's going to work again or now or with this specific brand or product. So it's a learning what to take and what not to take on.
Yeah, exactly. And the best advisors are really like the ones that kind of coax it out of you and make it feel like it's your,
like a therapist. Like you've got
that. Yeah, exactly. And ironically, that probably isn't the most common advisory. If you think of the archetype advisor, like, it's not that.
No. I think as well, when I, founders I've worked with anyway, whatever's got you to this point shows that you've got great instincts. Like, it is, you can bring a brand, a marketing expert in, but it's your brand. And that's a special and unique thing. And to be very respectful of that and nurturing of that, not to come in and be like, well, your brand house hasn't got enough layers and there's not quite enough jargon on this. You just send it back. What's been the hardest part of the journey so far and the most unexpectedly joyful?
The hardest, there have been a lot. I think, about a specific period, there's maybe two. So one was post-lockdown. I just, like, biz went from 5 people turning over a million to 15, turning over 4. We did the classic thing of we're going to grow 50%, having grown 400% and 100% before. And that's pretty minor to, like, you're attacking a shrinking market. And we grew 15, but we, like, levered up for that. And I just got... So people talk about burnout, and obviously everyone experiences it differently. But I tried to work my way out of burnout for, like, a year, which, because I've just... I'd worked my way out of everything, and, like, the solution to all my problems previously had been, like, work harder, and that got pretty horrible. Ironically, after a 3-week holiday, everything was fine, but yeah, that was pretty tough. And then the other one was a very acute moment where a fundraise that should have taken 3 months ended up taking about 9. At the moment the money came in, the business was being propped up by a personal credit card I'd somehow managed to get. And it was like £30,000 of my personal credit card debt was, like, the gap. Money came in, like, complete relief, can go back to doing the jobs I like and, like, building the business again. And then in 1 week, head of ops left, or decided she was leaving. Our warehouse, our roastery, and one of our production sites all moved, and something like 4 tons, which at the time, it's always a lot, but, like, that at the time that was, like, a lot of peanut butter, somehow got through the fuddled supply chain unroasted. And I remember being in Airbus, one of our first retail partners, and turning around and I was seeing a shelf of, so unroasted peanut butter is white because peanuts unroasted are white, and seeing a shelf of white Manulife. And I think, I'm not sure whether this is, like, a false memory, but I think I threw up.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But, like any crisis, it was an opportunity to change. And, like, subsequently, our supply chain is so much more robust, the checks in place are so much better. And it was very fortunate it happened then when it was 4 tons, which was, like, 2 months stock, whereas 2 months stock now is, like, 200 tons, and that would have been a disaster. And there's a few more, but I think we don't want to depress everyone. And then unexpected moments of joy. I mean, I've already mentioned that I met my wife selling her a jar of peanut butter, which has brought more joy than kind of anything. So that is still the one. Though this is minor. No, it's actually not minor. So when we launched a new customer, I will do lots of store visits. And I remember being at a Tesco in, I think it was Altrincham, so up near me. And I did go meet the staff and I just say hello. And I met this woman there, she's maybe in her early 20s, introduced myself, and she got quite emotional. And I'm going to get quite emotional talking about it now. And I was like, what's going on? Love it to meet you, come give her a hug. And she basically said that Manulife had saved her life, because she had, for 10 years, and this is very quite panic because I've got daughters now, but for 10 years, she had, like, savage eating disorder to the extent that, like, she wouldn't leave the house, like, was very unwell. And Manulife was the only thing that her mum had found that she found she could eat. And so that was like, yeah, it's nice.
That is, I think that is the amazing thing about working in food and drink is there's such small things, but you become part of people's lives. And that's why I love it, of that you've worked on or that you've touched, and you go to someone's house, it's on their shelf. And it's really part of the fabric of
people's
lives when you hear
food. Food is a key part of our Larry Norton's husband.
Yeah, lovely.
So yeah, that one was pretty, yeah. Clearly emotional. We're both tearing up.
Right, we're going to move on. Yeah, exactly. What's exciting you about the future for Manny Life?
So many things, but I'm going to try and do three. One is, to date, we have always been somewhat handicapped by our supply chain. And as of January, I mentioned, like, we brought in house. So all of that stuff is now within our control. And we are coming to the end of that 6-month bedding in period where the manufacturer is starting to like really hum. So I'm really excited to see what we could do when that like untethered. So that's one. Paired with that, I think it's something crazy, like still almost 90% of the country I think 80% of the country know who you are, but like only 90% of households have never tried Manny Life. And it's like when you witness the moment when someone tries Manny Life for the first time, it's like pretty magical, which just is like a blank canvas opportunity. So paired with them, we can now make as much as we like to, I was about to say attack those people, to give those people the wonderful opportunity of trying some great is really exciting. And then again, paired with the factory, I've managed to like tether the Willy Wonka style innovation like streak in my soul for almost a decade. But what our own facility offers us the chance to do, which no other brand can because they're all made in the same factory, is be that Willy Wonka. And that's really exciting because peanut butter is a magic product. Only like 40% of UK households buy it, and they buy it 2.5 times a year. The reason only 40% of households buy it is history of rubbish products. It exists in a really quiet part of the supermarket, and it's a planned purchase. And Willy Wonka, like streak, basically turns peanut butter from planned to impulsive. And I think that is like a really exciting, very unique place to be. That obviously has a load of operational complexity layered on top of it, but
you've got someone else who can figure that out now.
Yeah, in my mind, it works.
Yeah, this is it. You just do the idea, then you've got the team. They make it happen.
Yeah. Quite an offensive statement, that. But I guess to some extent, yeah. They would do it far better than I would, which is why I'm there. But yeah, I think it's mad that like such a small percentage of households or such a large percentage don't do anything with peanut butter. I think it's crazy that those that do consume it that infrequently.
When
the average male of consumer, as I'm sure you're aware, will buy it like 5 or 6 times a year.
Yeah, so I'd say that's more consistent with my peanut butter consumption. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to do a super quick fire round. Yeah. So, brand you wish you'd built?
It's Northern Pasta.
Yeah. Great product. Like,
and just, so one of the things about peanut butter is the category dynamic was there was a clear opportunity and it was commoditized, but in the UK at least, it's fairly small. Like it's £100 million, now it's £150 million market. 40% of households. Pasta, 98% of households, 1.5 billion. Frequency like off the charts. Like, and it is boring as anything. Everyone's doing the same thing and it's just retracted back to own label standards. And I think those guys have a monumental opportunity to create something insanely impactful in a really... So any supermarkets, listen to this.
Get it.
Or the other one.
Yeah, I was very happy. They're now on Ocado.
Yeah.
That's good news. Most underrated skill in a founder?
I think actually being a good salesperson is... People don't talk about that much. You're like always selling, whether it's like to come work for the early days, to supply for them. So that's one. And then this is very quite rare, but the ability to think in systems, be it like, so like to systematize, to basically take you off the hamster wheel into calmer, slowly, smooth, fast way.
Product you're obsessed with that's not peanut butter?
So two, they are a pasta sauce brand, but they are so much more than a pasta sauce brand. Called The Sorcerer. You might not have them, but I think they are going to be mega. I actually use them as like a pizza base or on when I do a little, I think uni, I've got one of those. Yeah, so that's mega. And then there are a fermented foods brand but they also do hot sauces, and like hands down the best hot sauce I've ever tried. But it's a brand called Eaten Alive, which you might have heard of. They've got big business like in kitchens, started by a couple of chefs, ex-chef from the library, and two great guys. But I go through 2 bottles of their hot sauce a week.
I'm always in the market for new condiments.
Like unreal. They're on Ocado. And okay. it is off the charts. Good.
Final question of the show. The question we ask everyone, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
We've already touched on it. It's like this obsession with personal connection and not necessarily finding a way to scale personal connection. Because if you get lost in that, it's very easy if it's become not personal. But I think like I've always believed people are far more interested in people than they are in products, and people are far more interested in people than they are in brands. And the brands who are able to like harness that in an authentic way, not a like celebrity endorsement way, of which I think probably the best I've ever seen is Get Baked by Rich. I think if you get that, that's like the brand of the decade.
Perfect. Thank you, Stu. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it. Thanks very much.